In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen. Grant us the grace, O merciful God, to desire ardently all that is pleasing to you, to examine it prudently, to acknowledge it truthfully, and to accomplish it perfectly, to the praise and glory of your name, you who live and reign forever and ever. Amen. Okay, the agenda for this session is to pick up where we left off with question 91 on the kinds of law. We're going to move that through that rather quickly. I think we've done a lot of the prefatory work. Speak for a minute about 92, Article 1, about law aiming at making us good. And then a quick review of eternal law so that we can get to the meat that we really want to address today, that I really want to address today, which is natural law, and a first attempt to start investigating that, properly speaking. So, question 91, the kinds of law. There are four articles that I asked you to take a look at. Just an overview, very briefly, of this question. Aquinas arranges law in a kind of hierarchy of order, with the eternal law at the top, and then you have other subordinated participations or concretizations of that eternal law. So kind of determinations as you move down the levels. And that's one of the most important things to grasp at the outset. And I think it's fairly obvious, so I don't want to belabor the point. And we can discuss it if there are questions about it as we go through. So let's just go quickly through these articles. I only asked you to read the first four, where he's talking about different kinds of law. And the first one is eternal law. This is a kind of special way of speaking about law, but Aquinas has carefully devised his definition of law so that it works across these levels of law, including with respect to God. So the key line in 91.1, why don't we take a look at it if you have your texts with you. He's asking, is there such thing as an eternal law? And the key line comes in about five lines into the I Respond, or what is sometimes called the corpus of Aquinas' answer. That's on page 8. He says, it is obvious that the entire community of the universe is governed by divine reason. Therefore, the very nature of the governance of things that exists in God as the ruler of the universe has the character of law. And the word nature there, the very nature of the governance of things, that's translating the Latin word ratio. Ratio is a very difficult word, actually, to translate from Latin into English, because it has lots of different possible meanings. It's a very rich term in Latin, and none of our English terms quite correspond to it. It sometimes means reason, sometimes it means idea, sometimes it means the essence. One easy way to think about that word ratio is that it can mean the intelligible content, whatever is intelligible. Now that's hard sometimes to grammatically put into an English sentence, but that's kind of what it's getting at. That's the heart of that word. So it can mean the definition. It can also mean the nature. We use the word nature in English often to refer to what Latins would say for ratio. If I say, like, the nature of this room is to be, you know, like, narrow with a high peaked ceiling or something like that. It was just the nature of the room that forced us to lay out the seats in this way. Well, does the room have a nature, strictly speaking, if we're talking about nature in a technical sense? But what he's talking about there is the way, the configuration of this room. So, back to Aquinas' text, the key line. So, the universe is governed by divine reason. So, the very ratio, that is the kind of the design, the plan, the idea, which in God can be summed up in one word, one grasp, one eternal moment, in which he conceives the plan of everything that is. So that is a kind of comprehensive sense of how everything, in a way, pre-exists in the mind of God. That's not just the essences of things or the natures of things, but how everything is going to unfold and how it's all coming from God and related back to Him. That's all in the divine mind, and everything that does in fact unfold is, in a way, unfolding from that conception of God's mind. And this, he says, has the nature of a law. Why? Can anyone think back to our definition of law and explain why? Why do you think this has the character of a law for Aquinas?
Against that, right, so regula and mensura were the key terms. So that's the thing against which all other things are measured.
Yes, okay, right. So that divine rule and measure, yes.
But it's also for the sake of the common good of the whole universe, and it's also, in a sense, the ab eo futurum communitatis, from the one who has the sake of the
care of the community. Yes, that's right.
The question is about the promulgation. I think that comes up in some of the objections.
Yes. Yeah, so we can take a look at that. Yeah.
I'm thinking back to the description of ordinance of reason. And so if we consider that God's intellect precedes his will, then it's all reasonable. So it's all kind of an ordinance. It's the quintessential ordinance of reason. It's the source of all intelligibility.
That's right. So God, by his reason, has ordered everything. And so this ordination of reason really is a kind of plan, and law is, in a certain sense, a plan. It's a plan that is kind of communicating to others and guiding them. So this is, even in God, there is an eternal law. Okay, now, what about the problem that the first objection raises? First objection: every law is imposed on someone. Now, this sounds like a modern, much more modern sense of law, right? But there was no one on whom law could have been imposed from eternity, since God alone existed from eternity. So you've got a couple issues here. One is just the question of time and eternity. The other is about this question of imposition. Take a look at Aquinas' answer. So his answer: things exist apud Deum, in God's presence, within God, insofar as they are foreknown and preordained by him. So even though things don't yet exist, his plan for them already has the character of a law, since it's a plan with respect to the things that are going to be ordered back to him. So there's no sense in which law is imposed on God. Law is in God insofar as he is ordering and governing. And then there's the reply to objection two about promulgation. I'm going to kind of skip over that because there's a lot of ground that I want to cover here. I just want to emphasize what you see here in this article: the theocentric character of law in Aquinas. So Aquinas puts God's divine reason first, and interestingly, it's not in one of the texts that we've seen here, but Aquinas says elsewhere that God's willing follows this plan. So he says, and I'm going to remark on this again in a minute, that the divine conception, God's wisdom, is like a law for his will. That's a very strange thing to say, but Aquinas doesn't hesitate to say it. Why? Because what he means is God's willing is ordered by his wisdom, by his plan of wisdom. So God's willing is not in the end arbitrary, even though God is omnipotent. So this takes us back to what we were talking about last time, about the whole cosmos as coming from God and ordered back to him. and existing in a kind of wonderful, multifaceted, beautifully ordered plan. And this conception in God's mind is what he calls the eternal law. Okay, so some points of contrast here. Eternal law does not mean that there's a whole bunch of divine commands. It's, in a sense, just the plan of creation. So it's not God issuing statutes. It's actually the plan that is sown into the very existence of things. So insofar as God creates them, he creates them according to this plan. Now, if we want to talk about divine positive law, God kind of issuing commands, that's what Aquinas calls divine law and treats in Article 4. So that's not what he's talking about when he says eternal law. Eternal law is this plan of the whole of creation. So eternal law is, you perhaps can now intuit, also connected to the goal-orientedness of all of creation, where it comes from and where it's going. How does that connect to Aquinas' definition of law? Somebody already mentioned it once, I think. An ordination of reason for the common good. What is the common good when we're talking about the eternal law? God himself. God is the universal common good. He's the common good of all creation. And the good, now interestingly, remember back to what we discussed yesterday. What were the notes of common good for Aquinas as opposed to a particular good that you might see in God as a common good of all of creation?
He's the end toward which all things are directed.
Yes, okay, very good. It has the nature of an end.
It's the good that's characteristic of the whole and not one of its parts.
That's right, okay, very good.
So it is not rivalrous.
Yes, it can be shared without being diminished. So, okay, very good. We're making real progress here. So creation, in a way, is incarnating or making concrete the glory and splendor of God, each kind of creature, giving us some hint as at the tremendous riches that God has in himself as their creator, who is being itself. All right, so let's now move on to natural law, question 91.2. This is just a first introductory article. Aquinas is not trying to give you the whole account of natural law here, but he does give you a very important orientation that he's that is like the framework in which everything he says on 94, in question 94, is going to take place. Yeah?
Very quickly on the eternal law before we move on. Does the eternal law include salvific history?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, the eternal law includes everything.
Right. So
divine law, divine positive law, would be, in a way, already included in the plan of eternal law.
Right. So going back to what we discussed yesterday over lunch, if the fall had not taken place, assuming there was free will, and if the fall did not take place, was there then an alternative eternal law that would have taken effect?
So we can talk about how God knows other things that he could have done but he didn't do.
Right.
But I don't think that's what Aquinas is referring to here, because he's referring to the plan that God actually, that guides his willing. So yes, God could have done something else, but the eternal law is the expression of God's ordered wisdom about what he's going to do. So this is actually, in Aquinas, also an important distinction between God's, you could say, his absolute power and his ordered power. His ordered power is what he does according to his wisdom, and we can understand that he could have created some other created order. But it wouldn't have been wise to do so according to that supreme plan of wisdom. Okay, 91.2, natural law. Okay, so this is just asking, is there a natural law in us? Not trying to explain it completely, but what Aquinas is emphasizing here is really the relation of natural law to the eternal law. And what do you find here? Natural law is a participation in the eternal law. Now, this is a very important kind of programmatic principle. It's not obvious how that principle holds in other natural law theories. But it is a very important point in Aquinas. So he begins his response, his corpus, this is on page 10, about how law can be in a thing. So it can be in the ruler and measurer, that which regulates, that's your translation, translates regula as regulation, but it also, it's the same word for ruler. A ruler is a regula in Latin. So a regulation you could think of as a rule or a measure. So law in the thing that rules and measures, and law in the thing that is ruled and measured. Okay, so in the ruler and measurer, we're talking about eternal law. That's in God. Or that same plan, in a way, as it is in what is ruled and measured. So here we're talking about natural law, which is, in a way, the way that we receive that eternal law, or the way it's that eternal law is reflected in what God has, in fact, created. So, Aquinas says, for a thing is measured and regulated to the extent that it has some participation in the rule and measure. Okay, and then he says, all things are subject to divine providence, and so they're regulated and measured by eternal law. So it's clear that all things in some way participate in eternal law. More precisely, because eternal law is imprinted on them, they have inclinations towards their own proper acts and ends. Okay, we're going to come back to that when we talk about question 94. Aquinas doesn't think that he's only talking here about human beings or even about animals. He's talking about everything having a kind of inclination. And that they're very low, rocks have very low level inclinations. They have inclinations to stay where they are, right? And not to be broken apart. Or, according to Aquinas' cosmology, they have inclinations to be down as opposed to up. I mean, we have to revise that in light of what we understand with respect to gravity. And, you know, so we might say they want to cluster together as opposed to being far apart, you know, when you get them on a macro scale. But in any case, he thinks that there are inclinations already there. So even, like, the laws of modern physics would be in some way expressing those inclinations of rocks and other things like that. But the important point here is that Aquinas immediately wants to move towards our participation in the natural law, since this, after all, is in the treatise on moral theology. So that's concerning human acts, how we order ourselves towards our end. So, among all creatures, he says, the rational creature is subject to divine providence in a more excellent manner because he himself participates in providence, providing for himself and for others. Think of the word providence. What does providence mean?
Literally, to see ahead or to see for?
Yeah, and also to, I mean, in English we would say to provide for, right? You're anticipating the needs of. So providence, in one sense, you know, we mean God's, the way God governs. That's what Aquinas means by providence. It's God's plan by which he arranges for all things. But we can be provident too. We can be provident for ourselves, for others. And so we really participate in God's providential activity by being providential with respect to the things that we are in charge of, as it were. And above all, that is, our own lives. So you are in charge of your own life. And, by the way, you can really screw it up. So don't do that, right? That's, how do you not do that? That's part of the, that's what Aquinas is talking about. So how do we do that? We don't behave just like rocks, or like trees, or like cats. We have a higher way of providing for ourselves by reason and choice. So we're able to think about what our life is all about, think about what is good for us, and make a plan about how we're going to realize it. And that is precisely the way we are provident for ourselves. And Aquinas thinks that this is, in a way, our participation in the eternal law. So God has created this unique creature, the rational animal, that is able to understand what its life is about and provide for it. And that's what you're supposed to be doing. That's why he's giving you reason. You participate in his plan of governance in a higher way than a cat does, because you provide for yourself.
So when he says natural inclination here, he doesn't mean like desire, he means reason. Is that inclination?
Well, okay, we're going to talk about that in a minute. That natural inclination actually has a wide range. It means desire, but he thinks that you have rational desires. I mean, just to get ahead of ourselves a little bit, if you get a cancer diagnosis and the doctor says, I've got to give you this chemotherapy, which is going to make you really sick, and you're going to feel terrible. You take it for a week, and now when you, the idea of going in and getting this infusion or taking the pills probably literally turns your stomach. Like, you know what it's doing to you. It's making you really sick. Do you have a bodily desire for that medicine? No, you do not. But do you desire it? Yeah, you do, actually, because your mind recognizes that you have to overcome the revulsion that your body feels, because otherwise you're going to die. And so people even really fight to get some of these experimental medicines that make them very sick on a certain level, make them feel very bad. And that's a rational desire. So it's a desire of your mind, which of course is much more potent than a desire of your body. Your mind can actually, we have complicated lives because sometimes our bodily appetites override what our mind tells us is the right thing to do. But our minds are capable of overriding our bodily appetites. Yeah?
Would St. Thomas Aquinas say that we could, that's possible without grace?
Yes, it is possible. I mean, just insofar as you can override, without grace, you can desire the medicine. But to really regulate it all, yes, you need the help of grace. After the fall, certainly, because we all inherit disordered desires. I mean, we inherit a human nature with a kind of twist, the wounds of original sin, the effects of sin. So we have disordered desires that are constantly arising in us. And our body doesn't just obey, our bodily desires do not just obey our minds. He thinks actually that in Adam and Eve, they did obey those desires. I mean, their minds were able to govern the lower desires. But that's another topic. Although it is important for understanding the whole picture. Okay, so, in fact, Aquinas thinks that it's kind of a metaphysical law of creation, that a being seeks its good, and we participate in that insofar as we direct ourselves by our minds. So, human beings, unlike other creatures, are not only moved from the outside, but we actively participate in the eternal law by reason and will, by understanding the world and our place in it, and directing ourselves and ordering other things, like we build buildings and we cultivate fields and we raise crops and we raise livestock and then we build computers and we do all kinds of things, very complicated things, in order to provide. And this is actually the way that we live out that participation in the eternal law, by providing for ourselves. But ultimately, Aquinas thinks, this is only working in the right way when we are directing ourselves to God. So if we accurately understood the world around us, we would see that that is where we come from and where we're supposed to be going. Yeah, Luke?
To clarify, even for non-rational creatures, there's a sense in which they're not pushed from outside towards their own good, right? At least for...
That's right. No, they're not pushed.
Plants, they have inclinations of our nature.
Yeah. No, they're not pushed. It's embedded in the being of the thing.
I think there is a sort of like modern inimical understanding where we think God is like manipulating pulses from outside, and that's not what he's getting at.
That's right. That's right. No, it's embedded in the very being of the thing. Yeah.
I'm fascinated by this. I don't know if it's the metaphysics of participation, and I don't know if Aquinas gets it from the Neoplatonists, or if there's a sense. I just a question about what really does this participation mean? Could the potency and actuality of Aristotle, for that book, is it that we participate by following an exemplar? Is it that we participate by doing actions, or is it actually that we participate by entering into a higher being of actuality?
I think it's some mix of all of that, and Father Raymond in the back is smiling because this is his special love. Father Raymond, you want to? But I mean, it's not that, don't think that this is super esoteric. It's actually fairly straightforward to grasp. I think you have basically grasped it, judging from the deep signs of recognition I see on your faces. Which is, are you feeling like, Father, you're misreading my face, I have not grasped this at all? Do we need to keep talking about this? Participation in a certain way, in a very basic way, just means it's the way that the eternal law is being received in the world of creatures, or the realm of creatures. Yeah, brother.
Yeah.
John Paul.
So I would like to have a distinction between this natural inclination or disposition and belief, because if you take it wrongly, natural desire can imply somehow a natural belief. If that is the case, you can blame the unbelievers. I don't know if you don't like.
Yes, okay, I think you're moving into the realm of like nature-grace debates and whether we need a gift, a theological gift of faith, for example, to believe. And of course Aquinas will say absolutely that's true, so I don't want to say anything that would suggest anything to the contrary. Let me bracket that, though, and come back to that maybe when we talk briefly about divine law. I just want to highlight one last thing before we leave this article. It's at the... towards the end of Aquinas' response on page 10, he starts talking about light. So he quotes Psalm 4, and then, so he's giving a kind of exegesis of the psalm. This shows you the theology, you know, the theological sensitivity of Aquinas here. It's not just philosophical. He says, "The light of your countenance, Lord, is imprinted on us." That's the quote from the psalm. "As if to say," he goes on, "the light of natural reason by which we discern what is good and what is evil. This has to do with natural law, which is nothing other than the imprint of God's light within us." Very interesting. What is he saying? God's intellect is a kind of light. He does think that reason, the power of reason, is like light. Think about this analogy. If you have ever had the experience of walking into, like maybe you're staying in a... you're visiting someplace, you're staying someplace, you've got a key to the door. This happened to me recently. And you walk up to the door, it's night, it's totally dark, there's no light there. You're trying to get the key into the keyhole. And that can be actually very challenging to do when you can't even see, like, you can't, maybe you've got four keys, you can't see which key it is, and you can't see which way is up and which is down. And it's very challenging to do. As soon as you have a little bit of light, you do it almost immediately. Because the light illumines the reality so that you can understand it, you grasp it. So that's just on the level of sense, right? If you move to the level of the spiritual reality that Aquinas is trying to describe when he's talking about the intellect, he's talking about the light of reason as, in a way, shining on the things that we perceive through our senses, and therefore giving us a grasp of the intelligibility of them. And this is what animals don't do. Animals grasp particular things. They don't grasp the essences of things. So dogs seem to be able to recognize, you know, this chair, that chair. But a dog wouldn't be able to give you an account of a definition of a chair. But we are able to do that as we encounter various things because our reason illuminates those things and grasps the reality. And he thinks that this is like what is happening with natural law, insofar as our minds are given a capacity, a sharing in that divine light. Now, it's a much weaker sharing than God has, of course. I mean, God has it in infinite perfection, by which we can grasp what is good and what is evil. And this is related to what Aquinas discusses elsewhere in the Summa Theologiae, the power of synderesis, or synderesis, it's sometimes pronounced. That is a kind of basic habit of the mind which is naturally given to us, by which we grasp the goodness of things, some things as good and other things as evil. And it operates on a very general level, but Aquinas thinks that it's in a way always given with the light of reason, so that you have a kind of basic moral knowledge, in a way, that is part of the light of the mind, or an aspect of the light of the mind, and can only be occluded or obscured if you really try hard. So you will basically grasp that, like, putting to death an innocent baby is bad. Like, people will grasp that quite intuitively, because that's rather close to the basic light that we have about what is good. I don't want to get too deep into the investigating this kind of basic intuitive grasp, but Aquinas does have a theory of that. All right, let's move on, because we still have a lot of ground to cover. I want to talk just very briefly about Article 3, about human law. What you see there is Aquinas' view of human law is that it concretizes and particularizes the natural law for a particular community and makes it much more definite. So it doesn't mean that everything in the positive law of a human community is just derived from natural law. Although, in a sense, that is true insofar as it's always going to be the case that a human community should be aiming at the common good and that its laws will aim at what is good for that community. That's already a kind of expression of the natural law. But whether the community is going to set itself up as a democracy or as an aristocracy or a monarchy, and then all of the other decisions that will flow from that, that, of course, will vary from community to community, and legitimately so. So Aquinas doesn't think that every human law is just a deduction, like a kind of rational deduction infallibly from precepts of the natural law. But he does think that human law is, in a sense, related to and derived from natural law. Now, we'll have much more to say about this as we go on and look at questions 95 and 96. Article 4, divine law, was that necessary? Aquinas says yes. Here we're talking about a kind of divine positive law. It's important for us, if we're going to arrive at our final end, given that it's a supernatural end. So, Brother John Paul, here's where, that divine positive law is known by faith. What I propose to do, though, is that we just keep moving forward, because I want to get to question 94. And I'll say just a few remarks about question 92, Article 1. Here Aquinas is taking up the effects of law. So now we're on page 20. Is it the role of law to make men good? So, what do you think Aquinas' answer to this is?
Yes.
Yes, okay. It's obviously already in the definition of law that law is ordered to the common good. So, he also thinks that that means the ordering of each individual member of the community to that common good is going to be encompassed within that those provisions of law. And he thinks that that will really make you good, make you virtuous. Now, he doesn't think that the law has to try to make you perfectly good, or that it has to outlaw everything that's bad. Some people want to assume that that's what Aquinas is talking about, but of course he doesn't say that. But I'd also like to point out here and have a little excursus on what human law really can aim at, or another way to put this, the limited transcendence of the political common good. So the political common good, or the common good of a human political society. So the political common good, what are we talking about? The good of a multitude, a community, in relation to the happiness of the community. It's related to virtuous living. So when Aquinas comments on Aristotle's Politics, he has this great line: the city is originally ordered not only that men live, that they survive, as it were, but that they live well, such that by the laws of the city, men live in accord with virtue. Because, now why does he say that? Because that's the way you're going to be happy, by living according to virtue. So we could think about this, just by way of footnote, I'm from Seattle. It is actually a part of the common good of a city, I think, a modern American city, that it have a winning NFL football team, you know? And that really does change the character of the city, when your team is winning, right? You go out on the street corner during football season in Seattle, and if you're wearing a Seahawks jersey, everybody is your friend. There's a kind of affability that pervades the city, and a kind of solidarity. Now, I think this is a much attenuated, a reduced, weak form of solidarity compared to what an ancient city that was united by its religion, for example, would have had. But it gives you some inkling of why, you know, the ancient Greeks thought having one cult of the city was important. Because it does kind of unite everyone in this spirit together. And in fact, well, at least if you go to Boston, I think the Red Sox are a kind of cult, right? You know? We could say idolatry even. I hope I'm not offending our Bostonians here. So the common good is not just the survival, it's not just the wealth of the community, but that the community would become a happy place to be. So for that, you actually do need, in some measure, virtuous citizens. So the proper effect of law is to lead its subjects to this kind of proper virtue. Now, it doesn't mean that the law is going to get into every detail of a person's life, but those things that in large measure affect the happiness, the flourishing of the city as a place where you'd want to live, those things are the proper objects of law, according to Aquinas. So, we do this in our own way of thinking. When we say, we want to encourage a good education for our citizens. Now, sometimes that's justified just on the grounds that we want people who will be increasing the GDP. So we want them to be productive in the sense of just generating economic wealth. But more generally, I think it's not uncommon for people to think, well, We also want some civic education, right? We want them to be good citizens, that is, engaging in our political life in a civil way, in a responsible way. We want them to be able to, you know, go to work and hold a job. That means acquiring certain virtues of personal discipline. And how does the law inculcate that? Maybe not by passing statutes, but maybe by saying, well, we want everyone to go to school, and at school we're going to teach you some of these things. So it doesn't, you don't have to think that the law is going to send you to jail if you don't get out of bed in the morning. Although on a certain level, that does happen with the public school system. I mean, maybe we don't have, maybe we don't send kids to jail anymore for not coming to school, but I mean, there are penalties. The point is, you're trying to form the citizen. Now, there is no suggestion here that the political common good exhausts the total good for the human being, or simply comprises the total good for human beings. And this is a very important point. It's an important point in order to understand the hierarchies of law and of goods, right? So the political common good is good secundum quid in a certain respect. And citizens are made good secundum quid in a certain respect. It doesn't comprise the whole of the possible goodness of the human person. So the civic law doesn't typically aim at the whole of the human good when it's inculcating virtue. It's inculcating the virtues that are needed for the political common good. And we have our own way of thinking about this as Americans. Typically, you know, we say, well, we need certain civic education and so forth, but these things will say don't affect the common good, and so we're not going to treat them. Like, your sexual morality doesn't affect the common good, so we're going to let you do. But then again, oh, well, maybe we want to say you have to practice safe sex because we don't want STDs, so maybe that's coming back in. I mean, in other words, it's complicated, and we will argue about what degree of virtue is actually needed in our education. But a very important point is that there are higher common goods than even the political community. And Aquinas has a clear sense of that. The political common good is subordinate to and is judged by nobler common goods. So think about the good of God or the good of religion. This means, very importantly, that for Aquinas, limitations on the power of the state don't just come from below. They also come from above. Insofar as a superior common good orders lower common goods to it. So you can think of our federalist system, where state law has to be ordered under federal law, and state laws that directly contravene federal laws get trumped by federal laws. That's a way of understanding how the state is limited from below by, you might say, principles of participation of the citizenry and the rights that citizens bring. You could have a theory of limited government from that direction, but also from above, insofar as the state can't transgress what the federal government wants to do. And in fact, Aquinas understands the whole of the political common good as being in a kind of similar situation with respect to higher goods. So more important than the authority of the political state is the authority that exceeds and transcends it. So what is an important conclusion from this? It's that the person, individual citizens, you might say, is not subject to the political common good in all that he is or she is. Precisely because the human person is ordered to nobler common goods than the state has competence over. And those nobler common goods are, in a way, the political common good is constituted under them. So this is how you can have a kind of Thomistic understanding of religious liberty. So I'm not going to try and build that out for you, but those are just some guiding principles to start understanding that. That when the state pretends to step into that realm, now you have a problem. And it's not just from below. It's actually because the state is transgressing on something that is above it. So that is part of the importance of question 92.1. Okay, I'd like to keep moving, if I may propose. Question 93 about the eternal law. And we've already sort of talked about this, so I think we can just go through this very quickly.
Sorry.
Yes?
Just quickly on this point about, well, without getting into the details, when the political good is subservient to, say, religious good, common good of God, does that mean to suggest that the state should stay out of religious issues? Is that what you just meant?
No, not necessarily. So the state, what is the right, really? I mean, well, what do you all think about that? Maybe I should just ask. Should the state, does this just mean the state is not competent to say anything about religion?
No, of course not, because, give the common good of God, the highest common good, what it's due, the laws have to, give the first, devote your society I don't know how you do it in a way that's prudent, but promulgating law on the basis of helping people get closer to God.
Yeah, so what you're saying is the law shouldn't just be agnostic.
What could it be? Well, it should be disregarding the highest word of the common good.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it depends upon if being a citizen is like the same thing as being a Christian, which was what it was formerly in medieval societies, but it gets harder in terms of the use of government force in religious issues when citizenship is broader than that, in a pluralistic society. That was the issue in the U.S. like the mid 20th century of looking at the problem of pluralism for Catholic political order with like John Courtney Murray, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you begin to see as you start thinking about it in these terms is that it's a complicated question, and the answer isn't immediately obvious. So I wouldn't claim to have a complete account of this all worked out. The principles, of course, are easier to discern than the conclusions from the principles. But you don't want a state simply identifying itself as the religious authority, or as having authority over, having competence for that higher good. But you also don't want it contravening that. So in a way, it needs to be ordered under it. Yeah, Anthony?
Yeah, so the other difficulty seems that after the fall, you can't even really have any real human flourishing without, talking about divine revelation. It doesn't seem that people can even function as rational animals properly without number one, the last step, and the strength of will that you get from charity after Nova, after that, and the other these virtues as well, not always kind of grapple with that.
Okay, I'd like to move on. So I think actually we can move mostly skip over question 93 because I think we've covered the key things. There may be interesting questions here that you all can bring up later. I mentioned this point about God's plan being like a law for his willing and acting, so I will not belabor that point. Let me just say this. One of the things that comes out in question 93 is Aquinas is talking about the eternal law, this plan of reason. It's very important, and you see it here, that Aquinas thinks that law is not an expression of God's will simply, but an expression of his reason, by which there is an ordering of all things to the common good. So, law is a rule and measure of acts, not primarily because a subordinate is bound to obey a superior, but rather there is a kind of obligation to obey because the law sets forth the ordered plan to attain the end, which is a plan according to reason. And so insofar as an act doesn't conform to that plan, it doesn't conduce to getting to the end, and so it lacks the rectitude of order, right? It's not rightly ordered. So that's the sense of obligation. Obligation is a secondary concept here, not a primary one. The primary one is actually reasoned ordering to the end. And Aquinas puts this first even in God. Now, why do I emphasize this? Because in the 14th century, with the advent of nominalism, and famously in William of Ockham, the Franciscan nominalist philosopher, this got reversed. And it's been very influential in our modern thinking. So Ockham understood law as ultimately rooted simply in God's will. Law is just an expression of the will of the sovereign. And you heard that in what Adrian was going through yesterday in the various definitions of law that the modern positivists have formulated. And they all relate in some way to this. They do not think that it is intrinsically an ordered plan according to reason. But it's law, it's a will, a decree of will that you must obey somehow. Now that creates all kinds of puzzles when you begin thinking about it that way, because you then begin thinking, well, why must I obey? In what sense is it obligatory? And there you have, you know, theories about divine command and, okay, threat of sanctions. And now it's not that those things are not present in Aquinas. It's just that they don't function at all the way that we're accustomed to thinking of them. Aquinas thinks that they flow from the fact that there's an ordered plan towards the end. So Ockham even says that God could, in principle, arbitrarily change his commands, and he could even command you to do something like hate him, and that this would be worthy of eternal life, like that you could get to heaven by detesting God. For Aquinas, that's nonsensical, because the whole point of heaven is that you're loving God. So that's that he gets you loving him now already in this life. So the end is actually related to what you do now on the way to the end. That's the way Aquinas thinks about it. Ockham simply understands arbitrary commands and then an extrinsic reward that's given at the end, which isn't related to performing commands except that God arbitrarily decided it to be this way. You see the very, very different legal landscape you're in when you begin to think that you put the will first. That's why it's so important for Aquinas that law is an ordination of reason, even in God. Yeah.
To that point, I'm wondering what you make of in question 94, article 5, the reply to objection 2, where he's treating these instances of God commanding adultery or in this case, the end of that implies that, and not only is the case that whatever is commanded by God in human affairs is by that very fact just, right? But also, as was explained in the first part, whatever is done by God in all natural things is in some sense natural. So, I mean, it seems to me, at least, that you see some of the roots of the divine command. So there are obviously corruptions of this, but and the proper way of thinking of it is in terms of coordination towards reason. But I mean, you do see this kind of thing even in Thomas.
Yes, okay. I mean, let me hold off on addressing that so that we can get to some of the earlier things in question 94, and we'll try to work our way up to that. I'm not sure that we'll get to it today, but maybe you can bring it back up in the in one of our later sessions. Okay, so I'd like to just now move to 94, where Aquinas is talking explicitly about natural law. So this is the kind of heart of the matter. And Aquinas begins with Article 1 asking, is it a habit? It's a kind of a strange question. It's not immediately obvious why he asked that question to us. The issue here, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. The issue here is simply what we saw earlier that he does think that there is a kind of habit of mind, it's a habit of practical reason, that is already naturally bestowed on our minds with the light of reason, so that we recognize or have some sense of the goods to be pursued and the evil to be avoided. They're first principles. They're not proved. They're simply present as the origin of our action. So I think I've said enough about that. We'll say a little more about this as we talk about goodness in Article 2. So 94.2. Okay, so I this is where I really want to spend a little more time. So 94.2 is a very famous article in Aquinas' Summa and very famous for natural law. There's been an enormous amount of ink spilled over it and a lot of misunderstanding precisely about this issue of natural inclinations. So it raises a threshold question for us about the meaning of nature. And when you say the word natural law, there's lots of different theories of natural law, and it depends on also what they understand to be natural about natural law. That's part of the point of disagreement among different natural law theories. So our first task is to get clear on what Aquinas means about natural and contrast it perhaps with some other senses of natural. So why don't I just start by taking a little poll. Can you give me, assume you're not sitting in a Thomistic Institute seminar and you're just talking to your, you know, you're just talking with your friends and you're talking about the way we in contemporary discourse use the word nature or natural. What are the senses of that in our common speaking?
Baseline, the animal, sort of.
Yeah.
Physical.
Okay. Can you use it in a sentence?
It's natural to sweat on a hot day.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Good.
Certain sense of purity.
Yeah. Okay. What?
I only eat natural food.
Exactly.
Nothing artificial.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, natural, you know, they're natural foods or whole foods, maybe somebody, you know, like they didn't use the word natural. That's interesting they didn't use the word natural there, but.
Spontaneous.
Yes, okay. So what would be an example of that?
Something like the argument that if I tell you not to think about a pig elephant naturally springs into your mind.
Okay, right. Very good. Yeah.
Something along the lines of that, it's almost like in Descartes, it's natural is that which is not dependent upon human reason, that which happens regardless of what human reason does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, so now that's a very, you're really advancing the ball with that statement, because I think this is, when you start talking about Enlightenment philosophy, or some of the those who were considered early natural scientists, you know, Descartes or Newton. I think it was it Newton who said that the goal is that we would become the masters of nature?
Bacon,
right. So the idea there, I mean, well, can anyone explain, Amy, you know it's Bacon, you must know something, what he means by that. That's right. So nature is, in a way, the raw material out there that by the power of our minds and our freedom, we can come to dominate and subdue, right? He has this idea of subduing nature and letting it, like, becoming its master in a hard sense of, like, master and slave, where we're going to put it to work for us. And you see this even in some contemporary ideological ways of talking about the human person, where I can become the master of my own body in the sense that I can even transform it by my freedom. So by my freedom, I can decide that I am a different gender, or I can decide that I am a different species, even. There are people who, in all seriousness, do make this claim. So that is to say, my freedom has such a capacity to overrule what is like the raw material. And the raw material there, does it have some kind of moral normative content? No, not in that view at all. Definitely not. Okay, so Aquinas obviously is not thinking along those lines, right? This nature now has a very different meaning by the time we've reached that view. You even hear people say, why should nature be normative? Isn't the whole point of us being human that we can become masters of nature and dominate the natural world with our minds and with our freedom? Like, that's part of our dignity as human beings. And there are resonances of that in Aquinas, like in the sense that, yes, we're supposed to be free creatures who can not just be subject to determinate laws, but there's also something missing from that picture. You could even then go from here to talk about things that are socially constructed, but I don't want to go there. Okay, so there have been subtle changes in the way these words are used, especially like if you think about nature and freedom, where in this modern conception, they're thought of as contraries. Like if it's by nature, it's in a way determined, and if it's by freedom, it is by way of contrast to nature. So nature is the raw material or deterministic, and freedom is completely undetermined. If you think about it that way, then you will be in this antinomy and you will find it hard to get out. Okay, but for Aquinas, it doesn't work that way. So for Aquinas, nature and natural, these are analogical terms that pass from at once the lowest biological level, or you might even say physical level, to the biological level, to the spiritual level. So I won't, maybe I can pass this out, but I'm not going to read it. You can read it later. This is a text where Aquinas talks about the analogical sense of nature. So on the one hand, he says nature may be contrasted with reason as denoting that which is common to man and other animals, especially that part of man which does not obey reason. And in this sense, that which pertains to the preservation of the body, or seeking food, drink, sleep, and such, we call natural. Okay, that is one sense of natural. But there is another sense of natural in human beings. And Aquinas says this, inasmuch as intellect and reason is the principal part of man's nature, this is the second full paragraph if you got the text now. I guess I am in the end reading it. I apologize. Where he says, first, inasmuch as intellect and reason is the principal part of man's nature, since in respect thereof he has his own specific nature. I mean, what is the nature of man? Rational animal. So that means that part of our nature is to be rational. So in this, on this level, or maybe to put this slightly differently, for Aquinas, we can start with the level of brute physical things, like rocks. We can ascend to animal nature, and we have an animal nature, and we understand how that works. We have hunger and thirst and sense appetites. But we also have a spiritual dimension to our nature. And this is not contrary to our nature. So our freedom is not contrary to nature. It's a part of our nature, as is our intellect. So in the physical world, nature entirely determines things. Like, think about the physics of throwing a rock across the room. There's determinate forces. In the animal world, likewise, there is maybe less absolute determination, but we see very clearly the way the inclinations work. And animals don't behave freely in that respect. They follow their instincts. And we can identify that also in us. But our spiritual nature has inclinations that don't oppose freedom, but actually are the ground of our freedom. That is, our spiritual capacities are what make us free. So we're not free in spite of our nature. We're free precisely in accord with our nature. So we have natural inclinations that deal with our body just as a physically existing thing. We have natural inclinations that deal with our animality as an animal thing. And we have inclinations of our spiritual dimension of our nature. Inclinations, for example, to friendship and love, to truth and justice. And those are also natural inclinations that are built into the kind of creature that we are. So if we recover this spiritual dimension of nature, then you begin to see how, for example, the natural inclination to truth is at the origin of all of your intellectual activity. It's a kind of first principle for your mind. And it's a source of the higher freedom that we realize in ourselves when our mind is freely contemplating the truth. Likewise, the natural inclination to what is good, this is not just a deterministic compulsion, but it's the deepest source of the kind of free spontaneity that shapes our willing. It's the attraction that gets us moving as free creatures. So it's in a way the root of our freedom. So we do speak in our common language of something like a thirst for truth. We borrow from a biological desire to talk about a spiritual desire. So spiritual inclinations like this incite us to freedom. And part of the task then for us is to recognize not only the lower desires that we have, but also these higher spiritual desires, these higher spiritual inclinations, and what that reveals to us about what kind of beings we are. So natural law, then, for Aquinas, is a kind of expression of our natural inclinations, which are written into our very being. So those inclinations are already there, insofar as we're physically existing things, insofar as we're animals, insofar as we are animals with rational souls, with faculties of intellect and will. And these inclinations then are developed through the course of your life, hopefully, into virtues by which you use or you actualize those inclinations well so that you reach the goal that they are pointing you to. So if we take a quick look, well, I'm not going to read them, right here. I hope to come back to them. The table of natural inclinations, this is in the latter half of question 94, article 2. Aquinas lays out five natural inclinations. Well, maybe let me just give you a quick outline of the Aquinas' response. This starts on page 39. He begins by talking in a way that is not obvious why he's doing this, about what's immediately evident or known per se, and then what can be demonstrated, and how things are known per se. as the life of the mind is in a way ruled by its grasp of being, like your mind grasps reality, what is around you, and the deepest principle or the original principle for any rational activity is what's called the principle of non-contradiction. Right? A thing which is founded on being, a thing cannot both be and not be in the same respect at the same time. That's a principle that cannot be proven by a syllogism or by an argument. It is simply a first principle that the mind immediately grasps as true. Aquinas thinks it's a self-evident principle. And he thinks that anyone who denies it, you can't engage in any reasoned discourse with a person like that. So it's just a presupposition, and it's unprovable, but immediately evident to us as true. It's a part of the light of reason that immediately grasps this. Okay, and similarly, he says, in this first half of 94.2, there's also the life of the will, you might say, or the practical reason, which is concerned not just with knowing truths in the abstract, that's what the speculative intellect does, but the practical intellect is ordered towards action. So what should I do? And here, the first principle is not just being, but the grasp of the good, which is the end, or the perfection, the goal. And he thinks that there is a kind of basic first principle of the mind, of the practical intellect, by which you grasp that good is to be sought and done, and evil avoided, and that this is the foundation for everything that comes later. So that, in a way, is the first natural inclination. It's towards the good. Now, there's much more that could be said about this, and hopefully I will say. Let's just lay out the other natural inclination. So you have the inclination to the good, and then he goes on, this is on page 40, after laying out that inclination to the good, this is towards the bottom of the page, he enumerates additional natural inclinations. He says, first, an inclination towards the good with respect to the nature he shares with all substances, that is, just to stay in existence. Rocks resist being broken apart. You have to exert a lot of energy to destroy a rock. Try to really destroy the matter. It's very hard to do. I don't know if we have physicists here who can tell us more about whether that's even possible. So our nature, insofar as it exists, resists its own destruction, and this is a kind of first inclination that belongs to our nature. Secondly, there is an inclination towards sexual union and the rearing of offspring. That's in accord with our animal nature. Then there is, third, an inclination towards what is proper to man as man, according to his rational nature. This is the higher level, the spiritual dimension of man's nature that I was talking about. So we've gone from physical nature, animal nature, now the spiritual dimension. I mean, these are not separate natures in us, but they're dimensions of our nature. The spiritual dimension of our nature implies that we desire to know the truth and to live in common, to live together. You might say, in a way, these are inclinations towards truth or knowing and loving, because your life together involves a kind of common bond of friendship. Aquinas will put that under the heading of love. So that, of course, directly corresponds to the fact that we have a rational nature that has powers of knowing and loving. And he thinks that what happens is as we reflect on our nature, we see that built into it is this directedness towards these goods, which are perfective of us. And therefore, what is then natural law? Natural law is as we come to grasp these, you might say, fundamental metaphysical traits of our nature, and we begin to act in accord with them. We begin to order our own individual lives and our communal lives in accord with the natures that we have. So you could present all of this in terms of precepts, commands, given from the outside. But more fundamentally, I hope it's clear to you now, these are coming from within us. And they are at the root of our personality and our freedom. So Aquinas doesn't think that natural law is in any way a threat to your freedom or your creativity. He thinks in a way it's the source of it. Because when you have an orientation towards your good, then you act with creativity and freedom to realize that good. And that's one of the wonderful things about human beings, is that we can act in wonderfully creative ways, different ways, manifoldly different ways, to realize the wonderful possibilities for the perfection of the human person. So a Thomist does it by studying Aquinas, but a ballerina does it by very serious work developing the tremendous refinement that's needed to be a ballet dancer. And that expresses a human perfection in a different way than a Thomist sitting behind his desk does. Okay, there's a lot more that I could say here, but I don't want to completely run out the clock. And we should be ending fairly soon. So let me stop there and invite your objections or questions. Yeah.
Can I ask two quick questions about these first principles of practical reason? So first of all, are at least all of those first principles that you listed, would Aquinas say that those are indispensable to practical reasoning in the way that the principle of non-contradiction is for speculative reason? And then also,
wait, can you name the principles? You mean that good is to be done and evil avoided?
And then seeking the propagation of our species, I think.
Oh, right, okay. That's.
Yeah.
All right, so the fundamental. He would say that the first principle is good is to be done and evil avoided.
And that probably is.
And that is absolutely, totally undeniable.
Sure. Yeah.
The subsequent, precepts, he thinks are self-evident. But it is possible, you can come up with, you can meet people who will deny some of them.
Yeah.
I think Aquinas would say they're being kind of fatuous in that denial. Like these are not going to be well-grounded denials. But when you look at the kind of being that we are, it doesn't, for example, to say procreation of children is not saying that every person must procreate, or that procreation is a constant moral imperative or something like that. That's not it. It's that this is one of the... There is clearly a drive for that. The sexual drive is a powerful drive. We can identify that, and we can see what good is it aiming at, and then we can try to order it with our minds towards its proper end. And that's part of what is needed for you to become a flourishing human being.
And then also, how do we know that, for Aquinas, that the first principles towards which we have habits are actually promulgated in the eternal law, as opposed to something else? In other words, how do we know that natural, not connatural?
Okay, that's a very good and interesting question. And the handout that I gave you actually has some... It goes on to talk about, is it possible to take pleasure in something unnatural? And that's in a way, another way of raising the question that you're asking. Because you could say, okay, well, in fact, I see in myself all kinds of inclinations to do things that may not be in accord with God's plan. So what sense do I make of that? And that requires some account, and it's more complicated in human beings than it is in animals, because animals don't have the possibility of defecting voluntarily from God's plan or losing, like having their intellect darkened the way we do. So Aquinas does have some answers to that. Effectively, he says there are some things that you can become habituated to, you can have a deformity that you begin to enjoy. But it's going to be destructive of you. So it's going to produce a kind of internal tension or contradiction, an internal division. So you will begin to experience real incoherence. So if you take a very obvious example, drug use, you know, if you you might say, well, actually, I'm really tempted to try heroin. You know, I just have talked to people and they say it just is so great when you're high. So maybe I should try it. Okay, you could say, yeah, I kind of desire it and there's a pleasure that I take in it. But if you begin doing that a lot, we know what happens. Like, your life falls apart. And the heroin addict eventually experiences very powerful desires and also may very well know, like, this is killing me. But that creates a deep division. Like, I may want to be free of the heroin, but I'm no longer even able to. So I think that's not a bad way to understand everything, every desire that's out of sync with the natural law. In other words, that is not going to lead to the flourishing of our nature. So if you begin heading down that path, you will find division in yourself. And you can just ask yourself, or you can think about this with people around you. Like, do we see this kind of internal division in people in our world? Yes, it seems to me we see it in spades, which suggests there's a lot of confusion about what will really lead us to our good. And, okay, another point to bring into this, that there is also a darkening of the intellect as you move in the wrong direction. So it becomes harder and harder to see what the problem is. And you can then just reach a point of hopeless despair, where you say, well, my life is just a mix of contradictions. There's no way out of this. Like, I cannot give up X, if X is heroin, or X is this sexual addiction, or X is, you know, you name it. I cannot give up watching Netflix until 3 a.m, you know, but I'm going to fail out of law school. Well, you know, you're going to have to, one or the other is going to happen eventually. So that kind of incoherence is what happens when you don't act in accord with these natural inclinations. Yeah, you're done?
Thank you. This natural law works well with someone who has the right reasoning, the right mind, who perceives his good or the true good. But what happens when one is perceiving the perceived good, which is not the true good? As Aquinas said in question 92, article 1, yes, even the evil, there is what one can perceive as good. So my question would be, what is good?
Yes, well, okay, that is a very big, that is the key question. Like, how do we understand the good? And he's giving you a kind of account of it. I mean, we've touched briefly on it. But the very simple answer is, for Aquinas, he doesn't define the good. He thinks that the good is also a kind of first principle that can't simply be defined. You can't explain it by something that's more primary than the good. The good is already a primary reality. So he gives a definition of law according to its causes. You can't give a definition of the good according to its causes, because the good is one of the first principles. So he describes it in terms of its effects, and he says, first, it's what's desirable. So you desire the good. You have an inclination for it or an appetite for it. And then he says the good is perfective. So the good leads you to your completion, as it were. So when we're talking about our finite natures, you know, what is good for me? Well, when I'm hungry, food is a good, because it nourishes me and keeps my body alive. But there are higher things that are perfective of me. Coming to know the truth is perfective of my mind. And I naturally want to know the truth, and I move towards it. So good is an analogical notion that operates in lots of different ways, like a chocolate bar is good in a different way than a lecture is good. A good lecture is really good, and a good meal is really good, but they're not good the same way. How are they? How is it good? Well, they're both, in a way, leading us to some kind of perfection. They're both desirable. They both display some aspect of completeness, or that they are completing us. So this is a, you know, to do a philosophical investigation of like what is the good is a big task, but that's some brief indication. I think maybe we should stop it there. Thank you very much.